From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Hampton Sides is my guest this week. He is the author of several books, including Ghost Soldiers, the epic account of World War II's greatest rescue mission, and Blood and Thunder, the epic story of Kit Carson and the conquest of the American West. His latest book is Hellhound on His Trail, the electrifying account of the largest manhunt in American history, the story of the murder of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Hampton Sides, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Good to be with you.
Hellhound on His Trail, as I said, it's now on paperback, has a new afterword that answers a lot of the questions that your book left readers asking, but I still have a few more.
Always happy to answer them.
Great. So is there any question in your mind that James Earl Ray murdered Dr. King?
There was when I first started the research, but after I got into it, I really did come to the conclusion that he did it. I leave a lot of doors open about how much help he might have had, who might have been helping him to travel around the country. There's definitely some strange things that he did during his fugitive year prior to the assassination, and also the 65 days after the assassination, when he was finally caught in London. There's some things he did, some meetings he may have had, some stories that crop up that are hard to reconcile, but I was never able to prove that there was any sort of super sophisticated, shadowy, high-level, highly financed conspiracy of the sort that a lot of people seem to persist in wanting to believe. So yes, to answer your question, I believe he did it.
He's the guy who pulled the trigger.
I think so.
Well, now, okay, so I know you're a historian and your book is really, you know, it's very well done. But now here's just a couple of, you know, we're just two people talking on the telephone. We happen to be on the radio, but forget about that for just a second. And like off the record, what are the things that you wanted to put in there but you couldn't prove them, so there's like other stuff that you would say if you could have. Is there stuff you're holding back?
Not exactly. I mean, the thing about Ray, James Earl Ray, is that he lied a lot. I don't want to say he's a pathological liar exactly, because I think there was method in most of his lying. He was deliberately trying to throw people off of the scent. He changed his story constantly to fool people. He enjoyed duping any kind of authority that he encountered, whether it was a judge or a lawyer or a journalist or a prison shrink or whoever encountered him. And so I did leave out a lot of stories that he told in his various testimonies and in his books that just didn't add up. Often interesting stories, but stories that could not be factually verified, or that were actually in contradicted known facts. But it is an interesting part of his personality. This need to lie, to throw people, to confuse people, to baffle people. I describe him repeatedly I've described him as a squid. Like somebody who throws up an ink cloud of obscuring ink to throw people off, to make people confused, as almost a kind of defense mechanism. And that's something that I think everyone who dealt with him over the years came away with this feeling of, like, what was that? Who was that guy? What was he saying? What was his point? What was his story, even? What was his name? Because he constantly changed his name. So if there was anything that I left out, it was just some of the crazy ink that he was squirting out of the squid that was James Earl Ray.
But you know, in your account, when you say, let me see if I can remember, he's driving to pick up those kids in New Orleans from Los Angeles, and he's driving back. Or no, where did he go? Not to New Orleans. But
no, you're right. Yeah, Orleans, yeah.
And then he stopped along the way and he made a mysterious phone call. And do you have any idea who he was calling?
Most likely, whenever there's anything mysterious going on, it usually ends up being one of his brothers.
Uh-huh.
He's very, very close to his brothers, Jerry Ray and John Larry Ray, both of whom were felons. And repeatedly throughout his year on the lam, he refers to a brother, or he tells someone he's going to go meet a brother. He says, even when he buys his rifle, and then he returns it, saying, my brother said I need a bigger rifle. We're going hunting together. The Ray brothers certainly were suspects. The FBI looked into them fairly closely, although maybe not closely enough. Ray, most likely the answer to your question is he was trying to communicate with one of his brothers. But that's not to say he didn't have some other criminal underworld contacts. I think the definition of a conspiracy is more than one person doing something. And so I guess in a way I am an adherent to a conspiracy theory. I think he had help. I think it was a crude conspiracy. I think it was low level and fairly desperate at times. But he was getting help. And so some of those phone calls he was making was probably criminal lowlife, underworld types that he was associating with, or his one of his brothers.
Well, you do an interesting thing when you write the book. I mean, you occasionally use hindsight, but mostly you're just moving along through the story. And, from the point where Ray escapes from prison in the beginning of the book, and you don't really talk for the first two-thirds of Hellhound on His Trail about his motives much, although you eventually do discuss many possible motives.
Yeah.
Do you think that when he broke out of jail, he broke out of jail with the intention of murdering Dr. King?
No, not exactly. I think Ray was a pretty mixed-up guy, someone with a very incoherent identity. He had a lot of ideas about how to make money that he talked openly with other folks in prison about. He talked about pornography. He was into fencing and smuggling schemes. He was a stick-up artist and was actively robbing liquor stores and drug stores and grocery stores. So he had a number of different irons in the fire, but he did talk about Martin Luther King, who he called Martin Luther Coon, when he was in the state pen in Missouri. He told one person there that he was going to make killing Martin Luther King his retirement plan. So it was one of his schemes. It was kind of in the back of his mind. But he also talked about getting out of the country and maybe going clean and, you know, running a tavern, becoming a bartender, owning a restaurant. You know, he had a lot of different ideas. And as he's moving about the country during that year, it's clear that he's trying on these various ideas. He actually wants to become at one point a porn director. He buys a bunch of camera equipment and tries to make a go of that and doesn't seem to have any success with it. He's also going to hypnosis to a hypnotist. He's taking bartending lessons, dancing lessons, reading a lot of self-help books. He gets a nose job. He's clearly a mixed-up guy who's searching for something, searching for some purpose, searching for some meaning. And I think the Martin Luther King thing probably entered his mind first and foremost as a business proposition, because there were a number of bounties out there on the head of Martin Luther King that he would have known about, one in particular coming out of St. Louis, which was his hometown. And I think he kind of, although he was a racist and he didn't like King, and it fit in with some of his racial politics, I think mainly he saw it as a business proposition.
Well, as we're following him along in your book, and you always refer to him by whatever alias he's using at the time, which I think is interesting.
Yeah.
As we're following along with him, there's never a moment where we suddenly go, oh, he's planning to kill Dr. Martin Luther King. You know, is there an aha moment there?
I know about when that aha moment happens, but because Ray never talked about it, and frankly because he lied so much, you know, we may never know exactly the cause of that moment, but it was March 18th of 1968, when he was living in Los Angeles, and when Martin Luther King came to Los Angeles to give a series of speeches that were covered by the local media. Something he said must have set Ray off, because he was living in Los Angeles, but he put in a change of address form suddenly, surprising the landlord of the place where he was staying, saying that he was moving to Atlanta, Martin Luther King's hometown. He had no connection to Atlanta. He'd never lived there before. He didn't know anyone there. And here he was moving there. And once he gets to Atlanta, it's clear that he's stalking King. He buys a weapon. He goes to various towns where King is talking. He buys a map and circles the place where King's house is, King's office, King's church. So something happened around March 18th that set him off. But, you know, I was never able to find that, you know, the exact quote or the thing that really got him going. Perhaps he got wind of this bounty that was out there on King's head. Who knows exactly? And that's one of the difficulties I think I had with the book, is that when you're writing about someone who never really came clean, who lied all the way to his grave, it's really hard to find that definitive moment, find that definitive motive. He's very frustrating that way, and that's just those are just the realities of the story.
We're speaking with Hampton Sides, and he's the author of Hellhound on His Trail, the electrifying account of the largest manhunt in American history, the story of the murder of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. Well, it seems to me that you have some respect for James Earl Ray's intelligence, his crafty ability to escape and stay at large, his ability to, and I think I'm quoting you here, to make shit up. did you find yourself kind of respecting him a little, or what?
I think that I came into this story thinking that, and I think a lot of people think this, that Ray was just this dumb hillbilly, you know, this country bumpkin. And that's certainly one of the things that has fueled some of the conspiracy theories. It's like, how could this idiot pull off a crime like this? Well, I found out that he really wasn't so stupid. He certainly did dumb things in the heat of the crime. If you look over the history of his criminal career, but this was a guy who had above-average intelligence. He read methodically and voraciously. He planned and plotted. He was very cunning. He had a certain street sense. In the lore of the Ray family, he was always the smart one. He was the guy that was going to get things done. He was ambitious. He did break out of two maximum security prisons. So this is not an idiot. And so I guess you could say, yeah, I came to respect his intelligence, not to say that I respect him, quite the opposite. He's a cunning killer and a sociopath, and someone who really, I think, fundamentally did not know who he was. I came to respect a certain strain of intelligence that he had is not to be, when you sort of follow his movements, you can't deny it.
Well, what about the other figure in your story? How did your feelings about Dr. King change or develop as you worked on recreating his last days, hours, minutes, seconds?
Well, I think I came into this story with a certain amount of awe for Martin Luther King. I grew up in Memphis, and I certainly felt a certain sense of shame, I guess, that he was killed in my hometown, and the role that my town played in bringing him to Memphis and you know, ultimately his death. I didn't want to do a hagiography. I didn't want to portray him as a saint. I wanted to portray him as a human being. So you get in those last months of his life a sense, I think, of a complicated guy, someone who has flaws, someone who, you know, he's wrestling with the future of the movement. He's got some of his own demons. He's stressed to the max. He's getting death threats all the time. He's drinking and smoking more. He's got, you know, he's got several mistresses that he's seeing. His marriage with Coretta is on the rocks. So, you know, it's a very difficult time for King, a very different King than I think than the man that we've sort of enshrined in our memories, but I think a more interesting King, because he's human. I can't really identify with or understand or relate to a saint, but, you know, I can understand a human. And so I think that I came away from this project with an even greater sense of awe for him and what he was trying to do, which was essentially to hold on to the last possible moment, his philosophy of nonviolence. That's why he came back to Memphis, to show that he could lead this march. The first march had turned violent, and some of the black power advocates in Memphis had sort of taken over his march, and he was trying to prove to the world that nonviolence still was relevant as a technique, as a philosophy. And so, you know, the courage and the kind of stoicism with which he came back to Memphis to do this thing everyone was advising him against made me respect him even more.
Well, I don't know. Have you gotten any reaction from African Americans who were in any way offended by the humanization of King in your book?
I don't know for a fact whether they were African American or you know what their background was, but there was definitely, you know, there's definitely certain people who have a hard time seeing King as a human. They, you know, there's no question about, for example, the mistresses, and there's no question about, you know, the stress that he was under, and it's not so much that they question the facts. It was just that they questioned why I would talk about that stuff. You know, why go into that stuff? It's sort of inconvenient facts. So I think it was more that I did it at all, not so much questioning the reality of it.
Well, I want to ask you about, if we can just talk about the last moments of his life for a minute.
Yeah.
I guess you really recreate those in the book. And what do you think? Do you think he knew what happened? Do you think he knew what hit him or not?
No. I mean, you know, it was a high velocity deer rifle. He probably didn't even hear the report of the gun. Now, he didn't die immediately. I think a lot of people think that he died on the balcony. He was rendered unconscious, but he didn't die immediately. He was taken to the hospital, and they did everything they could possibly do to save him, but there really was no hope. Now, another way to ask that question, though, is did he know it was coming? A lot of people have thought, you know, maybe because that eerie speech that he gave the night before seemed to indicate that, you know, he knew his time was near.
We've got some difficult days ahead, but it really doesn't matter with me now because I've been to the mountaintop. And I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And He's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over. And I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you. But I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
He had given versions of that same speech for several months, if not for the previous year. He had really... this is the other thing that had been going on in that last year of his life. He had really been talking a lot about death. He really didn't think he was going to live very much longer. He got all these death threats, and he started talking to his staff about who would succeed him, and he talked to Coretta and his family about it. So in a sense, he seemed to see the end coming, but I don't believe that he knew it was, you know, going to be April 4th, 1968. I think he thought that it was one of these days, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think it was a general sense of foreboding that he had.
I want to ask you also about the bizarre behavior of Jesse Jackson, you know, right after and in the days following the shooting?
Well, you know, Jesse Jackson has had an amazing, varied, interesting, controversial, colorful career, but on April 4th, 1968, he didn't acquit himself very well. I was interested in what happened in the moments immediately after the assassination, how people behaved, what the shock of an event like that does, and how it brings out different personality traits. And so I kind of looked closely at, you know, what did Andy Young do? What did Abernathy do? And they all played various roles, important roles. Jesse Jackson was the youngest member of the entourage. He was 25 at the time. He was himself, I'm sure, in shock. But he told everyone essentially not to talk to the media, and then himself started talking to the media, telling various reporters that King had died in his arms, that he had cradled his head, that he'd spoken his last words to him. And he started spinning this absolute fiction, presumably to create the impression that the mantle was supposed to pass on to him after King's death, when in fact Ralph Abernathy, the number two in command, was the guy who pretty much played that role. King didn't die in his arms. No one was holding King. It would be absurd to do that with someone who has had a gunshot wound like that. You know, you could do further harm. So it was a complete fiction, but, you know, there was this blood on his shirt, and then he went to the media the next day in Chicago and did an interview first on the Today Show, saying that, you know, this is King's blood, and he died in my arms. And, you know, he kept spinning this fiction, and it accelerated into this almost this kind of fable. All the other members of the King entourage were shocked and outraged that he was telling this story, which was not true. But in a way, I guess it kind of worked. I mean, he did sort of become the logical successor to King in many respects.
Eventually a presidential candidate.
Exactly.
Well, did he ever acknowledge his falsehoods there?
Well, it came out in the 80s, I guess it was, when he ran for president, and Mayor Koch of New York drug these stories out. And it was very embarrassing to Jesse Jackson, but he never replied to them. He never contradicted them. I think he and his advisors have always known that, like, the more you talk about this thing, the more embarrassing it is. Better to just leave it alone. And so, no, he's never acknowledged it. He's never talked about it. He's never sat for an interview about it. When asked about it, it's always been no comment.
Mm-hmm.
I sent him a note and didn't hear from him about it either. But there's no question that it happened. I mean, you know, you see the video even.
Right.
And it's just one of those things that people were in shock. People were behaving in all kinds of different ways that day. And his behavior was certainly one of the strangest.
Well, we're speaking with Hampton Sides, obviously an alias for an FBI agent, as some suspect. And his most recent book, Hellhound on His Trail. He's also the author of Ghost Soldiers and Blood and Thunder. Hampton Sides, you're also the reader on the audiobook of this. How what's that experience like, reading the book out loud?
It was one of the hardest things I've ever done. Reading your own book is hard because, well, at least for me, I'm always slightly unhappy with what I've written. I always think of how I could have changed it. Maybe it could be a little bit better. In a sense, I'm editing my own stuff, and I'm not objective.
So did you feel like changing it as you were reading it?
Yeah, a couple of places actually. It's like, who the hell wrote this? It's terrible. And I tried to change it in the read, and they wouldn't let me. They said contractually I was obligated to read what was on the page, even though I wrote it. The guy who was the director out in L.A. Said that reading a book is like digging a hole in the ground, a six-foot hole in the ground, with your face. Because at the end of every day, your mouth, your lips, your tongue, your throat, you're just exhausted. And You know, you do about 9 or 10 hours a day for 5 straight days,
wow,
reading a 400-page book. It takes it out of you. So, but I'm glad I did it. It was interesting to do, and I've gotten some interesting reactions from it. And I do think that books ought to be read out loud. I try to read my stuff out loud to myself when I'm unsure about a passage. I think this, you know, the sound of the language is important, and I think it's a good thing to do at least once.
Well, I think you did it as well as any actor could have. I mean, you seem to be having a little bit of fun when you played J. Edgar Hoover and LBJ.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not one of those readers who tries to assume the voice of all the different characters in all the quotations. Some will do that. They'll assume the voice of all these different people. I certainly found it really hard to try to assume the voice of Martin Luther King, for example.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't have that voice. But J. Edgar Hoover and James Earl Ray and some of the other minor characters, I did kind of at least meet them halfway in terms of adopting their dialect. It was an interesting exercise, and I enjoyed it.
Well, you did a good job. I think if people are interested, they should definitely give it a listen, although your wonderful afterword is not part of the audiobook.
Yeah, well, the afterword came as a result of going on book tour with the hardback and running into the conspiracy camp, what I would describe as a fairly small but very ferocious and very intense a group of people everywhere I met, and I realized that I had never really explained why I did not deal with some of the conspiracy theories, or how I dealt with them, I should say, and how I arrived at the conclusion that Ray, in fact, did it. And I think a lot of the conspiracy people just thought, well, I didn't know about those books, I hadn't read them, I didn't know about these various conspiracy notions that were out there. So I decided with the afterword to sort of explain a little of that, explain how I kind of waded through the conspiracy questions.
Well, right this moment, as people are listening, they are going to their computers and ordering the paperback on Amazon so they can read this fabulous afterword.
Well, there you go. And, you know, the thing is, you mentioned a pseudonym for the CIA.
Oh, right, one
of the things I also ran into was on the book tour, a lot of people who really did not believe that I was a real authentic author, that in fact I was paid by the CIA or the FBI to write this book, or that my name was a pseudonym. It's sort of was illustrative of the conspiracy camp that, you know, a person can't have independently arrived at the conclusions that I arrived at. That, in fact, you have to be part of the cover-up. You have to be part of the conspiracy in order to conclude that Ray did it. So it's amusing. At first, it was very amusing. People who know me find it kind of laughable that I'd be in the CIA or something. But after a while, it got to be a little annoying, and I decided to deal with a little of that in the afterword.
Well, the book Hellhound on His Trail also is a loving portrait of Memphis. I think you really a lot of the affection you have for Memphis shines through, especially in the opening sequences of your book. And I hope that whatever you do next, you'll come back and talk to us about it on From the Bookshelf. So Hampton Sides, thanks so much for being with us.
It's great to be with you.
That's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and you'll come back and listen to us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at KUSP.org or find us on iTunes and Facebook. I want to thank my guest, Hampton Sides. His new book, Hellhound on His Trail, The Electrifying Account of the Largest Manhunt in American History. I also want to thank our From the Bookshelf staff, the lovely Miss Breanne Beal, for all of her hard work. Thanks, Breanne. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.